Wow. As a dean, I've known that I can kill conversations. I didn't know I could kill all at once. Good evening. Welcome to the Arts and Sciences lecture. Thank you all for being here. I know there are probably some students here this evening for classes, for extra credit. And I would just ask if you would remain seated throughout the talk and the question and answer period so that there isn't too much disruption of the proceedings. And I would ask everybody to please check your cell phones. Being chosen by one's peers to be the Arts and Sciences lecturer is the highest honor that the College of Arts and Sciences bestows on one of its faculty. It's a peer-determined award that recognizes the significant national and international reputation of a scholar in the college. The award is bestowed on a faculty member only once in his or her career. The Arts and Sciences Lecture Series was established in 1968 as a means of honoring scholars within the college. It celebrates the crucial academic work of faculty involved in expanding the knowledge base in their disciplines. In addition, this series is one way that the college fulfills its social responsibility to interact with the larger intellectual community within which we operate by publicly engaging in the intellectual activities we so value. This evening, Dr. Mark Swerdlich, Professor of Psychology, will continue the tradition of the Arts and Sciences lecture. I would like to now introduce Dr. Scott Jordan, Chair of the Psychology Department, who will introduce Professor Swerdlich.
Dean Simpson, esteemed faculty, staff, students, family, and friends. On behalf of the faculty, students, and staff of the Department of Psychology, it is my personal pleasure and professional honor to introduce tonight's distinguished lecturer, Dr. Mark Swerdlich. For 34 years, Dr. Swerdlich has led both departmental colleagues and the department as a whole to developing a nationally renowned doctoral program in school psychology. These efforts have succeeded to such an extent that the program now stands at the forefront of research regarding National Guard soldiers and the challenges that they face after returning home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In a very real way, the program has now attained international status. It is inspiring to think that as Dr. Swerdlich completes this research, psychologists all over the country and even the world will have the chance to appreciate the high degree of professional excellence inherent in the school psychology program. Now, it's my job to tell you why Dr. Swerdlich is the person speaking tonight. Dr. Swerdlich's remarkable achievements over the course of his career stem primarily from his ongoing commitment to the field of school psychology. He has served as the coordinator of the graduate programs in school psychology since 1987. From 1984 to 1992, he led departmental efforts to establish our doctoral program in school psychology, the first such program at a public university in Illinois. This program now enjoys a national reputation. Specifically, it has earned and maintained accreditation by the American Psychological Association and was the first school psychology program in the state of Illinois to do so. The program has also achieved program approval from the National Association of School Psychologists. Now, while working to establish and maintain programs in school psychology, Dr. Swerdlich has co-authored two books, 23 peer-reviewed journal articles, 20 book chapters, and 19 test reviews. In addition, he has given 13 invited keynote talks, 84 presentations at national and international conferences, and 46 presentations at state conventions. Now, the numbers may seem a lot, but that's how we experimental psychologists talk. So, the majority of these scholarly achievements have been co-authored with colleagues and students. In other words, he is one of those truly remarkable scholars whose research endeavors have come to be intertwined with program management and leadership. As a result, scholarship and excellence constitute the very means by which the work is done. His research reputation at the national level is exemplary. In addition to the above-mentioned publications and presentations, he has served on the editorial boards of 5 journals, including prestigious publications such as Psychology in the Schools and Journal of School Psychology. In addition, he is a former chair of both the Council of Directors of School Psychology Programs and the National Association of School Psychology Programs. Now, these endeavors have been acknowledged by many national awards, including being named a fellow by the Division of School Psychology of the APA, as well as induction into the extremely selective Society for the Study of School Psychology. This organization allows only 110 members at any given time. He has also received the highest practitioner recognition for applied professional skills, the Diplomat in School Psychology, conferred by the American Board of Professional Psychology, and has received a number of presidential awards from NASP and from ISPA. In summary, Dr. Swerdlick has achieved a level of excellence that simply leaves many colleagues, including myself, in awe. And the fact that he does so calmly and with a smile makes it that much more impressive. With no further ado, Mark Swerdlick.
Good evening. Scott, thank you for that very kind introduction. I keep telling Scott if he wants me to retire, he has to stop treating me so well. I'd also like to thank Jane Zeller and Dean Simpson from the College Office for all the behind-the-scenes efforts that they've gone through to put together this event. So thank you, Jane and Dean Simpson. Also, I like to think of myself as student-centered, and I know the dean told students not to leave. I do want to let the students know that salsa magic is downstairs. So I will stop for a moment if anybody would rather, you know, go there. It's a great honor for me to speak to you this evening as the Spring 2013 Arts and Science Lecturer. I'm very humbled to be in the company of such a distinguished group of scholars and educators who have presented this lecture in past years, including a number from my department. In fact, the 5th Arts and Science Lecture was presented by psychology professor Stanley Marzoff 43 years ago in 1970, and more recent Arts and Science Lectures have been given by more contemporary colleagues of mine, including Laura Burke, Glenn Reeder, John Pryor, Ray Bergner, and Doug Lamb. I appreciate all of you taking time this evening to join me. In particular, I'd like to thank members of my family, a number who came from out of town, family friends, faculty, colleagues, and students, and our special honored guests, military service members and their families. One of the aspects of higher education that I've so appreciated over my 35-year career at ISU is the freedom to explore varied research interests and the encouragement to fulfill the public service mission of our university. My topic this evening focuses on my more recent efforts to integrate research and public service, 2 of the 3 areas reflecting the values and mission of our college, and involves my collaboration with the Illinois National Guard. I have had the privilege of serving as a member of our department's research team, consisting of a number of faculty colleagues and students, collaborating with members of the National Guard on researching topics of interest to military service members and their families. With the largest deployment of National Guard troops to war zones since World War II, our research team has become aware that military service has significant mental health implications, not just for soldiers, but their families as well. There exists a need to better understand the impact of deployment on military children and families and to provide appropriate support for them. In fact, a new area of psychology has emerged recently called deployment psychology, including the establishment for the Center for Deployment Psychology, which acts as a clearinghouse for both research and training in this area. As our ISU research team collaborates with the Illinois National Guard, we continue the legacy at ISU of research and service provision to our veterans, which began after World War II. The history of our university includes Illinois State Normal University, beginning in 1945, serving as one of several national centers providing counseling to our returning war veterans, World War II war veterans. This represents an overview of this evening's talk. A recent senator got into trouble when he drank water. I was resisting having to do that, but this represents an overview of my topics this evening. My goal is really to summarize the social science research in this area and to highlight studies conducted by ISU students and faculty. At the outset, I'd like to recognize our National Guard collaborators, several of who are here this evening. May I ask each of you, if your name's on the screen, to please stand and be recognized? We very much appreciate you coming, and we very much here at ISU value our partnership with you and look forward to future collaboration. Now we'd like to recognize other service members, including those currently in the military, veterans or ROTC members. May I ask each of you to stand and be recognized? Do you have any? Stop. We certainly thank each of you for your service to our country. We also acknowledge that families of soldiers sacrifice as well. Representing families of service members, I ask Scott and Amy Christensen and members of their family to please stand. Scott and Amy are parents of Robbie at the far left in your picture, who's currently in the Marine Corps. Scott, next to Robbie, is in the U.S. Navy Reserves, and Scott's father, Robbie's grandfather, on the far right, is a Navy veteran. May I also at this time ask other family members in the audience who have either had or currently have a loved one to please stand, if you've had a loved one in the military. Although only 1% of Americans serve in the military, members of their family serve and sacrifice as well. We certainly thank all you family members for your sacrifice for our country. I'd also like to recognize support from grants from the National Guard Association of Illinois, who has funded the research that we've done with the Illinois National Guard here at ISU. The NGAI is an organization of soldiers, airmen, and families of the Illinois National Guard, and they're dedicated to advocating statewide and nationally for the combat readiness of the Illinois National Guard and also caring for the well-being of the soldiers and their families. So we certainly thank the National Guard Association of Illinois. Yes. Colonel Schweikert is the past president of that organization. This is a listing of my psychology department colleagues, graduate students, and undergraduate students who have worked collaboratively with the Illinois National Guard on our research. I'd like to begin with a few statistics to provide some context for my talk this evening. Over 2 million service members have been deployed in recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Military dependents, which includes spouses and children, now outnumber military members, and nearly half of military service members have children, with 1.9 million children from newborn to age 18, 1.3 million are school age, and since 2001, approximately 2 million children have experienced a parental deployment. Current military families have experienced the longest, most frequent, and most cumulative numbers of deployments in the history of the United States. Research suggests that it's not the number of deployments, but rather their cumulative length that has the greatest impact on soldiers and their families. The typical length of deployments is 12 to 15 months due to lengthier trainings and periods away from home for staging and extensions. And the typical number of deployments is 2.2, with some members of the active army having, or the active military having, as many as 5 deployments. Changes in the U.S. military have increased the risk factors commonly experienced by military families. Largely as the result of the history of conscription or the draft, through the end of the Vietnam War, the majority of the military was comprised of single young men. As the war in Vietnam came to a close, several things occurred. First, the size of the active army decreased dramatically from 3 million to 1.5 million service members. Second, the conscripted military gave way to a force comprised entirely of volunteers. And with this shift came an increase in the diversity in numbers of married service members. Currently, 71% of the officers and 40% of enlisted personnel are married. 42% of all military personnel have children. And women now make up 14% of the military, which means mothers are being deployed, which increases risk factors for families due to societal expectations of women serving as primary caretakers in families. We have come to understand that deployment is not an event, but rather a process with generally predictable phases for military families. Defining deployment as a process that potentially begins before the service member departs and continues beyond his or her return home allows one to consider the multiple influences that deployment has on family life. The pre-deployment phase typically begins when the service member receives notification of an impending deployment. The ensuing time between the actual departure date may be a busy time, with the soldier balancing an increased workload together with family responsibilities. And some difficult decisions or difficult discussions need to occur in a family during the pre-deployment phase. They need to talk about how to handle finances and how the deployment will affect the family finances. They need to discuss what if the soldier is seriously injured or killed. They need to be sure a will and insurance are in place. And also, it's during the pre-deployment phase that the family first begins to contemplate what life will be like without the soldier being present. The deployment stage specifically spans the date of departure through the first month of absence and may involve initial adjustments to family routines, like mealtime routines, or if they're children, bedtime routines. This is also time that the family establishes communication with the soldier, which could be email, Skype, or cell phone. Children may have a particularly difficult time dealing with what's called boundary ambiguity, where the deployed parent is physically absent and psychologically present, and the children are unclear about what roles each family member plays. The sustainment phase lasts from the end of the first month through the beginning of the final month of deployment, during which new routines are established. So the remaining spouse or parent takes on more responsibility. There might be different roles and responsibilities redistributed in the family, like who pays the bills, who reads the bedtime story, how are household repairs made. The next phase, the anticipatory return phase, is the time just preceding the service member's homecoming, and is typically characterized by a shift in the family activities in preparation for the service member's return. It's typically the anticipatory return stage where there's a great deal of excitement and anticipation. The reunion or homecoming stage is when the service member returns home. This is typically characterized by a great deal of euphoria. The reintegration phase typically lasts from 3 to 6 months and may in fact last for several years. During this phase, families face the task of renegotiating roles and areas of responsibilities and establishing new routines, or what's called the new normal. The remaining spouse has learned to run a household alone, do the work of both people, and establish their own routines. The spouse left behind may find that they enjoy taking care of some of the responsibilities, like paying the bills, and may find, in fact, that they do a better job than the deployed service member. So there needs to be a period of resorting of responsibilities of the household and how the workload is divided. Integrating the service member back into the family may be particularly difficult for young children who may not even remember the deployed service member, and children may have adjusted to only one caretaker. There's currently a dissertation study conducted by school psychology doctoral student Silas Dick and chaired by psychology professor Adina Myers, which investigates the patterns of stress, coping, and resilience across the various phases of deployment. Although the dissertation study has a small sample size of 20 families, it is unique in that it's a longitudinal study following the same family through all phases of deployment. The three phases are pre-deployment, deployment, and post-deployment or reintegration. It's also unique in that most of the research in this area is done on the active Army, but this particular study was done exclusively with National Guard families. Preliminary findings suggest at each phase, family members view roles as unhealthy or problematic. And there was stress associated with each phase of deployment, although there were no significant differences in stress levels between the different phases. There was also slight decreases in what are called protective factors, like social support through the various phases of deployment, and an increase in risk factors such as parenting stress that increased across the deployment cycles. The study results also found that emotional support or social support, particularly emotional from close family members and close friends, mediated the demands upon family functioning. I've heard several briefs, what are called briefs, by chaplains who have talked to members of the military returning home, to families, to members of the community, and they use the analogy for particularly the deployment and post-deployment or reintegration phase of a canoe on a smooth lake. And essentially, at deployment, one of the parents in the canoe jumps out of the canoe, and what happens? It becomes unsteady, it shakes back and forth, then during the sustainment stage, it eventually stabilizes and continues to run smoothly, but then what happens at reintegration? The soldier jumps back into the canoe, family's obviously happy to see the soldier, but what happens? It rocks back and forth, it's very unsteady, and so again, there needs to be time to stabilize, which is what occurs when responsibilities are resorted and communication is reestablished. One of the areas we've been involved with the collaborative research with the Illinois National Guard, focuses on the reintegration phase of deployment. Research has indicated that homecoming or reunion is part of the reintegration experience and has an impact on post-war soldier adjustment. We do see some differences in the homecomings for soldiers through wars in the 20th and 21st century, and I wanted to briefly highlight those. During what was referred to as the Great War, World War I, 1914 to 1918, many soldiers returned home with invisible wounds, which at the time were called shell shock or war neurosis or combat stress, and now recognized as post-traumatic stress disorder. Typically, there were large public homecomings welcoming them home, as seen in this video.
When the Harlem Hellfighters came home, more than 1 million people cheered as they marched up Fifth Avenue to a hero's welcome.
However, after the parades, there were no real programs or efforts to help the World War I veteran reintegrate back into civilian society. Studies on World War II veterans have found that higher combat exposure has been associated with long-term physical and mental health challenges. There was a study at Harvard University that found that 56% of World War II veterans who experienced heavy combat died by age 65. They also found that a high percentage returned with what at the time was called not yet diagnosed nervous, but today would be referred to as post-traumatic stress disorders. Most of these veterans suffering from these symptoms did not seek mental health services. Now, when they did return home, there were typically public homecomings like this famous Life magazine photo that you see here, which is of the New York Times Square welcome home celebration. I remember my father-in-law, who was a World War II veteran, loved to tell the story about the public homecomings in Chicago. When he couldn't walk into a bar and buy his own drink, he couldn't walk into a restaurant and buy his own meal because there was such euphoria welcoming the soldiers home. So in addition to the public homecomings, there also were many informal homecomings, such as the one depicted in this famous Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post cover. Many of us recall our fathers, grandfathers, uncles, and other family members who never really talked about their experiences of war. We assumed they had adjusted, but came to learn in their old age that many live with many secret demons that were expressed in later years but had an impact on them throughout their life. And of course, there were no formal programs, reintegration programs for World War II veterans either. Homecoming for the Vietnam War veteran was very different than experienced by the World War I and World War II veteran. Other than Vietnam prisoner of war release receptions depicted in this famous Pulitzer Prize winning photo, there were few community homecoming events held for the Vietnam War veteran, nor were there formal reintegration programs to facilitate their readjustment back to civilian life. Many returned with what was formerly referred to as post-traumatic stress syndrome during this war. There exists much mythology around homecomings during the Vietnam War in terms of confrontations with protesters, reports of protesters spitting on returning soldiers. However, it's clear that more formal community-sponsored public homecomings welcoming the Vietnam War veteran and thanking them for their service to our country really didn't occur until over a half century later. The United States has been involved for more than a decade in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, leading to many goodbyes, but also, thankfully, many homecomings. Due to much different societal attitudes toward the all-volunteer military and supported by social science research that suggests the type of homecoming soldiers receive does have an impact on their post-war adjustment, homecomings have been much different for veterans of the post-9/11 wars. Here's a few examples. Those are certainly expressions of pure euphoria. Many soldiers report that they dream of their reunions with their families, and soldiers and families also expect that the euphoria of the homecoming reunion phase to continue. But many common challenges await our veterans after the joy of the homecoming event depicted in the video dissipates. Research has identified four areas of challenge that include new demands and stressors. The first is family issues. Many combat veterans report when they return home, they feel like strangers in their family. The challenge is establishing new routines as the old ones have gone through considerable change since the departure of the service member. There's also the challenge of re-establishing communication with family members, including their partners and children, and children may have a particularly difficult time because they may have changed significantly while the service member was deployed. The expression that I think counselors talk about, and we have several here, with the families is you need to establish a new normal. Job and work issues also is a challenge, and the challenge here is adjusting to civilian employment. In the war zone, the soldier may have been responsible for millions of dollars of equipment. Their daily decisions might have been life and death decisions, but when they return to their civilian job, they may have much less responsibility, and the decisions they make are not as high stakes. The third area is personal reactions, and the challenge here is feeling like oneself again. Typically, or often, veterans report after the euphoria of the homecoming has passed, they may feel somewhat out of place, have an overall feeling of things being strange. They may have physical symptoms, such as trouble sleeping or headaches, coupled with mental or emotional symptoms like nightmares, flashbacks, feelings of nervousness, fear or guilt, and a tendency to become easily upset. Female soldiers tend to feel more anxiety, where male soldiers tend to feel more anger. Many veterans report having problems with loud noises or surprises because it reminds them of the noises of combat. There also may be problems with driving, as a soldier returning from a recent conflict may respond to litter on the side of the road as if it was a roadside bomb, and as they did in the war zone, automatically swerve away. Being able to adjust to routines of daily living is the fourth challenge. Soldiers in war zones may not have had to make decisions of what they were going to eat for their meals, what they were going to wear in terms of their clothes. They might not have had to do their own laundry, yet when they return home, they have to fulfill these daily life routines. It's important to normalize these challenges for veterans and their families, but it's also important to monitor them as well. We've talked now about some of the challenges. I thought you might like to hear about these challenges briefly from soldiers in their own words.
I noticed when I came back home, my family situation. They were kind of standoffish a little bit. And that's probably a change that I noticed. And it was something that the interaction wasn't the same. And I don't know if it was maybe some fear on their part or maybe not understanding some of the situations that I've been through and how to approach me on those kinds of things.
After 15, 20 minutes of being in a crowded room, I felt uncomfortable.
I just didn't want to talk to anyone.
I didn't want to hear their questions.
What happened? What did you see? What with everything? And I just didn't
want to
talk about it.
Things just aren't the same anymore. What's going on and with me and my life?
That was always the best medicine for me. Because if I could sit down with somebody who was there right beside me and explain to them something that bothers me every single day, and they could say, yeah, I remember that street, or I remember that building we were in. I remember when so-and-so was wounded or so-and-so was killed. I was there. It's a little bit different than telling a medical professional.
I didn't notice anything was wrong with myself. I think it's when you're in a tornado, you really don't notice anything's wrong because it seems so normal, you're so calm.
The spouse tells you that you're different. My spouse deployed, she came home, I tell her she's different.
Coming back, still dealing with all the injuries, and get a little bit more riled up and anger issues, and my wife starts noticing, and she's like, hey, you're not the same.
I noticed that Aaron gets real angry over real silly things. Aaron before was very bubbly. He's happy all the time. He enjoyed life. He likes to go out, make friends.
She's like, hey, you're just feeling too angry. You're having all this, rage and stuff, and you need to get some help.
That kind of made him step back and realize a few things, and I asked him several times, please go to therapy. And I just basically told him I can't live like that. It's too difficult.
People are viewing me a little bit differently, and maybe it's something I should probably look at a little bit more, and maybe we'll talk to somebody about.
After being in the military for so long, you never really feel you have a problem because you go on deployment, you come back, you're with the same people you deploy with generally in the unit. That's your support network a lot of times for many, many soldiers and veterans. But once you get out of the military, where's that support? Who can I depend on now?
All your topics when you come home are about war and your unit and all this stuff, and nobody wants to hear that. Nobody can talk to you about it,
Just kind of put it off, and then finally went in and just started getting seen.
Vet centers are a good place because they're confidential, but they're not the only place. There's lots of things out there that you can do.
I don't know if he would have ever gone to therapy if it weren't for his family, and I don't know that he would have the same outlook on life. Family's huge. It's very important.
We want them to know that we are there for them, that we have their back. And just like, you have your buddy's six in combat, we have their six out here in the civilian world.
Tell
talk to somebody always. Even if it's just a friend or anything, just talk to somebody.
You know what, I need to talk to somebody about this. I can't be like this anymore.
You've got to do something. So you finally did. We're definitely a stronger couple. If we could get through this, we can get through anything, that's for sure.
Although most soldiers make a satisfactory adjustment after they return home, combat stresses lead to significant mental health challenges for many. Survey data indicate that almost 1 million troops had at least one mental health problem since 2000, and 13 to 20% of the 2.6 million military personnel serving in Iraq and Afghanistan have had symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Soldiers with PTSD exhibit intrusive thoughts such as chronic flashbacks and nightmares, severe guilt feelings, which psychologists are now calling moral injuries, where the soldier may feel extreme guilt over actions taken on the battlefield, such as the accidental killing of civilians. Other symptoms include emotional withdrawal and emotional numbing, which relate to symptoms that reflect difficulties in experiencing positive emotions like happiness or love. Symptoms may also include increased anger, elevated levels of aggression, as well as hyperarousal reflected in difficulty concentrating and difficulty sleeping. These symptoms make it very difficult or impossible for the returning soldier to resume their former roles as parent, partner, or contributor to the household income. Other mental health disorders experienced by war veterans may include mood disturbances such as severe depression. Post-traumatic stress disorder is particularly devastating because veterans will often self-medicate with drug and alcohol to alleviate the symptoms. Research suggests that 64 to 84% of veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder will also suffer from lifelong alcohol abuse disorders. Veterans suffering from PTSD also exhibit significantly higher rates of marital and family issues. They have higher return divorce rates, higher incidence of domestic violence and child maltreatment than those without post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, recent statistics suggest there's a higher incidence of child maltreatment among veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan than in previous wars. These veterans typically don't access mental health care. Potentially because of the high symptoms level and inadequate treatment, suicide rates have increased among soldiers and now surpass those in the general population. In fact, currently soldiers are experiencing the highest suicide rate in the 26 years that the military department of the Army has been keeping records and surpass age and gender adjusted rates in the U.S. In 2012, 349 active members of the military took their own lives, with more soldiers dying from suicide than from combat-related injuries. If suicide statistics include all veterans, the numbers increase dramatically, with estimates that 22 veterans commit suicide each day. Research has found that soldiers from the National Guard and Reserve experience a disproportionate burden of mental health symptoms following their return from recent wars, faring significantly worse than soldiers in the active component. Up to 42% report mental health issues, suggesting the need for mental health follow-up 3 months after their return. If you think about it, National Guard soldiers have unique circumstances that make their post-deployment period higher risk for emerging mental health issues. They are not stationed on military bases and have fewer built-in social supports, such as easy access to peers who have similar experiences that they do. If you remember on the video we just saw of the veterans, they talked a lot about the comfort that they feel when they talk to others who have similar experiences. experiences. They also don't have, the National Guard soldiers and their families don't have easy access to chaplains, family support programs, and military health services. Instead, deactivated National Guard soldiers are dispersed throughout their communities and they're expected to reintegrate quickly back into their civilian communities and jobs. These soldiers depend on local community resources to address their needs. They also experience more financial stress than those in the active military. Wives of National Guard soldiers have a higher unemployment rate. Off base, the military have less access to affordable health care. They spend more than civilian families on child care, and they have less discretionary spending than those in the active military, which all adds to their financial stresses. Additional risks are associated with greater combat exposure and also a longer cumulative length of deployment. Being a school psychologist, I'm particularly interested in the impact of deployment on children and the role of the school as a protective factor. Certainly, these children say more hellos and goodbyes, and they have more practice with Skype than civilian children. What does the research say they worry about? Well, they worry about possible geographic location. I think particularly children of National Guard soldiers, because they don't have that easy access, the family doesn't have easy access to other families and peer support, they often move closer to their immediate family, which causes the child to be displaced from their school and their peer group. They worry about their deployed parent being injured or killed. They worry about how the deployment will influence family routines and roles and responsibilities in the family. And they also worry what life's going to be like when the deployed parent returns. They also worry about financial limitations. They worry about their parents getting along when they return from deployment. And they worry about the next deployment. Military children also report it's hard to find support from people outside of military families, that people just don't seem to understand what they're going through. There's been a great deal of research on the impact of deployment on children. Tends to fall in four areas. They look at internalizing symptoms, which would be depression, anxiety, eating disorders, sleeping disorders, externalizing symptoms like aggression, oppositional behavior, rule breaking, the impact of deployment on academic adjustment like grades, achievement test scores, attention in the classroom, homework completion, and peer conflicts. It's interesting that reviewing the studies on military children over peacetime, the Vietnam War, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan found that mental health issues have become more prevalent for children whose parents are deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, the statistics suggest that pre-Iraq and Afghanistan mental health disorder prevalent rates were in fact lower for military children as compared to civilian children. There is a relationship between the adjustment problems among military children and their parents being deployed to war zones when they compare to military families and parents who have not been deployed to war zones. Some predictors of negative psychological and behavioral health outcomes among military children include frequent and prolonged separations, frequent moves, and a very key one being the stress level and coping ability of the left behind parent. Stress and anxiety of the left behind parent can be transferred to the child when the parent shares developmentally inappropriate information with the child, such as his or her own grief, loss, or fear of spousal injury or death. Military children can also experience what's called secondary traumatization, in which returning veterans transfers personal war-related trauma to their children through, for example, obsessive retelling of war stories or expressions of excessive guilt over war violence. Children may internalize these frightening experiences, which are certainly much removed from their own realities, in an effort to identify with the traumatized parent. We know many military children do adjust, and what we need to do is study more what might be called protective factors. Why do some children experience adjustment problems and others don't? The research to date shows that these are protective factors. Healthy home environments in which family members communicate effectively and it's a cohesive family. As I mentioned before, caregiver is able to manage, the remaining caregiver is able to manage their own personal stress and is free from psychopathology. Other protective factors are stable parental employment and where the child is not uprooted from their school and their peer group, financial stability, the degree of social support from families and friends and the community, and an interesting one, the family recognition of hero status for the deployed parent. Also, there are some information about viewing the school as a stable place or a sanctuary for students, but there isn't much literature on that. I was talking to some of our National Guard collaborators, say that's the next area I'd like to look at, is more specifically schools and how they can serve as protective factors. We've talked about the different reintegration challenges, and I'd like to talk briefly about three different approaches to addressing reintegration challenges. The Illinois National Guard, along with Minnesota, and Justin Einweiler, who's here, was the project director of Yellow Ribbon when this occurred, but really Illinois and Minnesota led the nation in the establishment of the mandatory reintegration program for our National Guard soldiers when they returned from war. The Department of Defense now mandates a Yellow Ribbon program for all branches of the military and the National Guard in all 50 states. The Yellow Ribbon program views reintegration as a three-legged stool. The soldier is at the base, and the soldier is supported by community, family, and their employer, and these are targets of the reintegration program. It's also a preventive program for families throughout deployment and specifically targets soldiers upon their return. Just talk briefly about some of the events in the Yellow Ribbon program. The first is called the Tier 1 event. It occurs approximately 30 days after the soldier returns. It's mandatory for soldiers. Family members are invited. The main goal is to talk about the common reintegration challenges. There is an opportunity for soldiers of like rank to discuss some of their challenges. There's also breakout groups on what their employment and educational and medical benefits are. There's an informational fair so they could be connected with service providers. The Tier 2 event occurs 60 days after the soldier returns home. It is mandated again for soldiers and families are welcome, and it tries to expand on the Tier 1 program. They have, unique in Illinois, is they have a series of focus groups that is more like group therapy that's actually led by trained mental health counselors, and they tend to focus on common reintegration problems like anger management, substance abuse prevention, and compulsive behavior prevention like gambling and viewing pornography. There are service providers available at this event as well. The 90-day event is mandated for soldiers, but family members are not invited, and this is when the soldier undergoes more comprehensive mental and physical health assessment. This occurs approximately 90 days after they return home, and service members are also available. Family reunions is part of the reintegration program. Certainly families are an important part of the reintegration programs and supporting families. So these occur 45 days prior to the soldier returning to the United States. The target audience is spouses, parents, significant others, and children, and essentially it reproduces some of the tier one objectives of trying to educate family members on the kinds of reactions they may expect when their soldier returns, some of the red flags they should be aware of, the resources, service providers, and benefits that the family have when the soldier returns home. Community reintegration training, we know social support from the community is also important. So throughout the deployment cycle, there's a series of community reintegration trainings talking about the challenges of reintegration, what the reintegration experience looks like, how the community could support families throughout the deployment cycle. It includes its targets, law enforcement, government officials, employers, drinking establishment owners, and mental health and medical workers. We know that faith-based institutions can have an important role to play in a successful reintegration experience. And so there's efforts to assist clergy and lay leaders of not only talking to them about the challenges of reintegration for soldiers returning and the reintegration experience, but also how they can help families throughout the deployment cycle. In fact, the Illinois National Guard has a special initiative called Partners in Care, which is by the Chaplain's Office of the Illinois National Guard, and its goal is to provide clergy with the knowledge and skills to provide education and support services to children and teens during the reintegration experience. The final component is education, and it targets first, primary, and secondary teachers and staff. There, the goal is to educate them on how they could support children of deployed parents, and there's also a component to target us at the university in terms of post-secondary teachers and staff to talk to us about how we can support veterans during the reintegration effort, because many veterans take advantage of the post 9/11 GI Bill. As I said, ISU is one of these college campuses. In fact, here at ISU, we've been identified as a military-friendly college by GI Jobs Magazine and a top military-friendly university by Military Advanced Education, the Journal of Higher Education for Higher Learning for today's service member. Our ISU Counseling Center stands ready to assist veterans with mental health challenges, which is consistent with our campus history that I mentioned at the outset, that we served as one of several national centers providing counseling to World War II veterans. Currently, ISU has 400 veterans here on campus. Our first collaborative project with the Illinois National Guard was an evaluation of their Yellow Ribbon program. We surveyed several hundred soldiers. This was a study led by Jake Linnell and Silas Dick. What we found was, in fact, soldiers and families gained new knowledge. They did report that events were relevant and useful, and it did reach a major objective of the program for a greater understanding and awareness of resources and services. We did find that one size didn't fit all, meaning married soldiers had different needs than single soldiers, and also soldiers with children had different needs than soldiers that didn't have children. And in fact, now I think the Yellow Ribbon is trying to focus even more by having smaller workshops, by bringing in more local resources, and giving more time to do what the soldiers on that video talked about, being able to talk among each other. We also looked at mental health status and how the reintegration experience was going, and we found that more positive community support, so soldiers who said, somebody I didn't know thanked me for my service, and also stronger family support, such as, my family is proud of me for my war service, which is similar to that war hero status I had mentioned earlier. We found that both community support and family support was associated with a more positive reintegration experience. The second type of program to address reintegration is peer outreach support program. It's modeled after a program in Michigan called the Buddy to Buddy program, and in Illinois it's called Warrior to Warrior. Essentially, it uses volunteer veterans who are assigned to National Guard units, and they attend on drill weekends, and they're under the supervision of mental health professionals. The idea here is that soldiers will be more comfortable again talking with somebody who's had a similar experience, and the hope is that those war veterans, the volunteers, will be able to hook them up with appropriate resources. And also reduce stigma, such as confidentiality. Soldiers are worried that if they seek mental health services, it won't be confidential and it will have a negative impact on their promotions in the military. And they also worry about the perception of being perceived weak by others in their unit. One of the things we're finding or we're anticipating is with many soldiers returning with significant mental health problems, and that this in fact may overwhelm the VA. We also know that National Guard soldiers and families, like I mentioned earlier, depend on community resources and support services. So in collaboration with the National Guard, we asked the question, what do soldiers want or what characteristics would they think is most important in civilian mental health counselors, and also what they think is most important for their children. And this is a study that was led by a school psychology graduate student, Jennifer Jensen. We surveyed several hundred soldiers, and what we found, what was rated most important, was counselor experience and military knowledge. So does the mental health professional have training in working with the military, working with soldiers and common reintegration challenges and mental health challenges? And not only do they have the training, but do they have the experience? Less important, but also important, was consular professionalism, which clustered items fell on availability and also treating soldiers with respect and empathy. Office setting, we thought maybe having a small office and out of the way would be important. Office setting wasn't as important, but one of the items that did load on this was personal hygiene. In other words, they rated important the consular had a clean and well-groomed appearance. The final item, I guess some of us as psychologists need to take that to heart. The fourth most important, certainly less important than the others, the first two, was consular affirmation of pro-military attitudes and communication of pro-military attitudes. These were items like, do you want your consular to go to community events that support the military? Do you want your consular to communicate that they support the military and they support the war effort? And interestingly enough, that was rated as least important. A few take-home points I hope you take from my talk this evening. Civil War General Tecumseh Sherman said that war is as hell. Although I've never experienced combat, I have talked to veterans, and from my readings, that's certainly true for modern warfare. In fact, some may suspect that it's even more difficult because now our enemies don't wear uniforms and there's no front lines. Also, as the cumulative length of deployments increase, resiliency is waning. Remember I said it isn't the number of deployments, but the cumulative length of them that has the most impact on soldiers and families. It's important for us to know that it's a different reintegration experience for National Guard and reservist veterans who don't live close to or on a military base, and it's also a different experience for their family. They don't have that easy access to peer support, which is so important. Although most soldiers adjust satisfactorily, for as many as 33% of our war veterans, they do develop significant mental health challenges. We know there exist common challenges during reintegration, and it's important to normalize those. We also know a relationship exists between parental deployment and child adjustment, and what we need to do now is explore protective factors, and one area I'm hoping to look at is the school. We also know the involvement and support from family members. We know the importance of social support from non-family members, like close friends. And in fact, the involvement and support from the whole community has a positive impact on the reintegration experience, which means we all have a role to play. I hope by reviewing with you this evening some of the research related to challenges faced by soldiers and their families, as well as some of the approaches that the military and others are taking to address them, will encourage you to help strengthen the yellow ribbon for our soldiers and their families by committing, as Jill Biden writes in her children's book, "Don't Forget God to Bless Our Troops," a simple act of kindness to a military family. What could that simple act B, it could be an offer of help with childcare to provide the stay-at-home spouse a respite, because we know of the strong relationship between the left-behind parents' mental health and ability to deal with stress on child adjustment. It could be helping out with household chores like shoveling the snow or mowing the lawn, or it could be a simple thank you to the family or the service member for their service. As I come to the end of my talk this evening, I ask for your indulgence for just a few more minutes. I've been very blessed to have a long and satisfying career at a single institution, ISU. This longevity resulting from a high level of job satisfaction is attributed to only one factor, the people who make up this institution. I've been very fortunate to have very supportive department chairs. I think any of us that are faculty in the audience knows it's really your department chair that could either make your work life like walking through a beautiful garden on a sunny day, or like being stranded in a hot desert with no water. I've been very fortunate to have all of my department chairs, and several are here this evening, who has made my work life like walking through a sunny garden on a spring day. I've also been very fortunate to have past and current school psychology colleagues. They've been a bright, passionate group of colleagues. We don't always agree on every issue, but we work very, very hard at collaborative problem solving and trying to create the very best professional training for our graduate students in school psychology. And I think we are all proud of the program and proud of our students. I've also been blessed with very capable non-school psychology department colleagues. As a group, they're exceptional teachers and productive researchers. I've certainly appreciated their contributions to our school psychology graduate program, and also to me personally. I've learned a lot from them and have enjoyed collaborating with them over the many years. And finally, to the many current and former students who have really been such a joy to work with. They're bright, they're highly motivated, and it's given me such pleasure over the many years to see them succeed in their chosen profession of school psychology. And most of all, I'm grateful to my family, including my wife Peggy, daughter Jenny, son Danny, and son-in-law John. I thank them for their support all through my academic career. I am sure each of you in the audience recognize that anything you accomplish professionally is never accomplished in a vacuum, and you need the support of your family. The members of my family have certainly supported me, and I'm very grateful and love them very much. And I don't want to forget the most recent additions to our family, our twin grandchildren, Colin and Grace. So certainly if there's any questions, I'm certainly glad to respond. I know people are probably smelling the cookies in the back, but if there are any questions or reactions, I'm certainly glad to respond to any of them. Yes?
Does a lot being said about your study was a National Guard. Are there National Guard people here? Yes? Yes, okay. Your deployment is not where we pick you up and send you to Afghanistan for X number of years. Am I correct? Your stateside?
The deployments are to Afghanistan or Iraq or...
So then how are you different than the Army, the Navy,
Oh, go ahead.
Basically, while we're deployed, we're in an active status. We're treated the same as active Army or Air Force or whatever branch we're with. The primary difference is, before we deploy, we work in a civilian job or live in a local community. And the point of Dr. Swartz's research is, when we return, we're returning to, instead of returning to Fort Knox, where there's all these services and everyone that we deployed with is together, we split out to 100 different towns across Illinois, and we're going back to work at Caterpillar or Burger King or wherever. And therefore, we are reintegrating individually instead of as a group. And we don't have all those services available.
But when an an Army person goes to Afghanistan, they come home. Don't they end up back in their home community again looking for these services?
They end up back at Fort Knox or Fort Campbell
they
with the same 100
home.
People. No, because they're active duty. They live at the base they're stationed at.
And that's really the challenges and why we see, I think, a higher incidence of some of these mental health challenges among National Guard, because what we find is social support is so important, that peer support, not just for the soldiers, but also for the family.
So then when you come back to Bloomington, I assume, yes?
I live in Peoria, but...
All right. Do you go back to your old job or to your old employer?
Yes.
And is your job there?
Yes, there's a law called USERRA, Uniform Services Employment Reemployment Rights Act, that guarantees my job is there. They may temporarily hire a backfill for me. When I come back, I go back into the same position.
And that's true of the National Guard. Is that also true of the Army, the Navy, and that?
Well, the Army, if you're in the active Army, your job is the Army.
The Army, correct.
Right. But if you're working for a civilian company, you would go back to your civilian company to be a office manager or whatever you were before you left. And again, that's a different thing because no one else in your office went through what you went through.
You have no one else to talk to.
Correct.
Which is his point.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate all of you. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see your question.
Well, I was just going to say, it's my impression also that a lot of National Guard people didn't really think they were signing up for that kind of deployment. It wasn't really a choice in the same way that people that enlist. Would that be mostly true?
I would say for the first few years of the war, that was certainly true. At this point, everyone in the Guard has either enlisted or re-enlisted since 9/11. So everyone that's in now is aware of that coming in. But certainly for the first several years of the war, there were people that have been in 20 years and never deployed before, and suddenly they're going there.
I think it'd be interesting if we could look at those cohorts, those who signed up not thinking, thought they would be stateside helping in floods and those kinds of things, versus those, like you say, who signed up knowing that they could be deployed. Anything else? Well, thank you again very much.